welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, poetry chapbooks, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 3, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston. And my guest today is a man who burst onto the podcasting scene a few years ago with shows like Giant Size and Screen Time on the 5x5 network before going solo to create ESN, the Electric Shadow Network, in 2014, where he now hosts shows like Giant Size and Screen Time. He's a pop culture aficionado with eclectic tastes and someone I first met when I appeared on his comics show, so it's my pleasure to now return the favour and welcome him to Unjustly Maligned. He is, of course, Mr. Moises Chayan. Moises, welcome to the show.
So glad to be here, Anthony. Yes, I still technically host Screen Time under a new name, Electric Shadow, the namesake of the network itself. And as we mentioned before we started, there are about 11 billion other shows on the network now, which are lovely and wonderful, ESN.fm. I'll shamelessly plug myself at every opportunity. So how does your show work and how do I not ruin it?
There'll be plenty of time for that later, don't worry. So what we're going to do here is talk about something that you love that most people don't. So the first thing I want to do is ask you for some context. Tell us what you've chosen and then give us the context of when it was released, how it was released, how it was received, and why it's maligned, why most people think it's a bad piece of work or just simply don't like it.
Well, I chose something specifically that I find is maligned. In a certain respect, it is popular within a certain subculture, and I feel like in both respects, it's a disservice to the piece of work, and that is the 1989 film The Wizard, starring Fred Savage. Those who immediately brighten up at the mention of The Wizard generally do so because they are avid video game fans, and they recall that this is the big screen motion picture from Universal that introduced the world to Super Mario Brothers 3 before it was released. And that's fine. That's great. It's great that there are a lot of people who, in their childhood, like myself, dragged their parents out of the theater to see this because it was the movie that they were going to see the new Super Mario Brothers in. And that was the age before the internet, when such a thing was only doable on a movie, on a television program, something like that. The thing that I find generally sees it maligned in the critical press, in the popular press, is just that, is, oh, well, it's the movie that they made. It's effectively the Mac and Me of Nintendo games. Mac and Me is a also maligned movie that I'm sure someone out there loves. I don't. That was effectively a feature length commercial for McDonald's here in the United States.
Wow. I'm very glad that didn't come across the pond.
Oh, it's terrible. It's really, really terrible. And you should strike anyone from the list who says, that's what I want to come on and talk about, Anthony.
No. Now I have to go out and find somebody who loves it.
Well, you have to go and find the movie and then find someone that you think is capable of the task of, who can honestly tell you that they love that movie. And that will be a rare person indeed. For me, the thing that sets The Wizard apart in particular is that, yes, there are a lot of late 80s, early 90s cliches and sitcom-level tropes that are all over it. There are devices like the kind of pool shark brought to an amateur's game to win some money, but in this case, you recast the pool sharks and the people in the pool hall with kids in an arcade at a bus station. Things like that that are very, very, very basic, very general kind of junk food cinema tropes. And that's all well and good, but the thing that really stands out about it, that touches me personally, is the wizard of the title is the younger brother of Fred Savage's character, who is developmentally disabled. They don't explicitly state what sort of developmental disorder he has, whether it is autism, Asperger's, what term they would have used at that time, but he is driven to continually run away from home and walk, hitch rides, find a way to get back to California. California, 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 the kid keeps repeating. And at the very beginning of the movie, he is put into an institution by his mother and his stepfather, her new husband. And this is something that struck a chord with six-year-old me, that there was a question of what would happen with my younger brother who was diagnosed with autism. At the time, the option was effectively, well, there are institutions, there are homes for that sort of thing. At the point when parents can't deal with a kid anymore, or when they grow to a certain age and the parents grow themselves to a certain age, they can't take care of a child. That was something that was an ever-present threat in the back of my mind that I worried about, that I was concerned about. And it was something that, as goofy and silly as many elements of the film are, really touched me as the Brussels sprouts being snuck into the macaroni and cheese, the bit of nutrition snuck into the otherwise junk food filled cinema spectacle that was designed for mass audiences looking to buy Nintendo games.
Well, and let's not forget that in 1989, the vast majority of the public would have never even heard of autism or even Asperger's, I don't think.
There was a very broad impression of, well, that kid's retarded, that kid is a retard, that kid is a moron, an idiot. You know, there's something wrong with that kid, and it would be spoken of in tones and given looks like the kid was a leper walking around in public.
That's what I mean. There was no awareness that people with learning difficulties, or as you say, developmentally disabled kids, there was no awareness that there might actually be something wrong with them, physically wrong with them, other than just, yeah, oh, they're a bit thick or whatever. That wasn't really in the mainstream conversation. So it is interesting that this movie decided to kind of put that out there for no real reason other than as a MacGuffin. That's the other thing. I know it's having... I'd never watched this movie before. I'd never even heard of this movie before you told me.
I'm shocked they allowed you into the video game industry having not seen this movie. I mean, it's a prerequisite.
Before you told me that, that this was what you chose, and I was like, I'd never heard of it. And having watched it, I mean, really, although it's treated fairly sensitively, it is basically a MacGuffin to just get this kid, well, it's an excuse for him to be good at video games, and then it's a way to get them to go to this, to go on the road trip, you know, that takes them to California.
Well, if I can say, I've never read an interview or anything that indicates this is the case, but it feels like there has to be some inspiration taken from the Who's Tommy, Tommy being a pinball wizard.
Possibly,
and
yeah.
It feels like there's a little bit of that, but it was somebody read, I don't know, an article in Psychology Today or something like that about this thing called autism. Oh, great, this is perfect. We'll just conflue these two things, and this works perfectly as a device. As a storytelling device, it really does work quite well and is much less...
I will say one of the things that struck me about the movie all the way through, and I think this is more, not just this movie, but a symptom of the times, was how quite dark it is in places, how bleak it is on occasion for a kid's movie. You know, there are quite a few elements of the movie that aren't pure entertainment, that are actually, touch on fairly mature themes that I don't think you'd see in a lot of, in an equivalent movie aimed at kids these days.
I completely agree. And in opening 10, 15 minutes or so, the brothers, Fred Savage and Luke Edwards.
Buried the lead there. Fred Savage.
Fred Savage is the star of this movie. And his younger brother, Jimmy, played by Luke Edwards, are heading off together after Fred Savage's character effectively kidnaps Jimmy from the institution that he's been put into. They're out somewhere in the desert Southwest, and they've built a fire overnight. And I just can't imagine a movie released after maybe 1994 doing something like that.
That would encourage kids to do that, yeah.
Yeah, where the kind of copycat things that a kid might get into would just be too potentially dangerous. But
and without consequences, yeah, as well. That's the other thing. It's not like nothing bad happens to them as a result of doing these things.
No, not whatsoever. And they meet Jenny Lewis, who people know better as Indie Music's Jenny Lewis, Rilo Kiley's Jenny Lewis, at this bus stop. And she was in her kid actor phase at the time, before she really got into music later on in life. And she is playing what I guess today we would typify as the Disney Channel spunky heroine type of character.
Completely, yeah, yeah.
Who is very much also on her own. And this was an era where you could get away with these movies where your main characters were kids who were out on their own doing things unsupervised, and it was not just having not a negative effect, but it was having a net positive effect overall, and that them running away or disobeying their parents was, in fact, the reason that their journey came to a successful conclusion.
So hang on, let's rewind a minute here, because we've gotten quite in depth quite quickly.
All right.
So let's just point out to people, and like I say, I've learned this because I'd never even heard of this movie, but I've learned this since, that the reason it is maligned and the reason most people have bad memories of it, or one of the main reasons, is that it was regarded at the time as basically a 90-minute commercial for Nintendo.
Exactly.
And, you know, just a movie that basically did nothing except advertise Nintendo video games and arcade games.
Right. And throughout the movie, as they make their road trip across the country to California, you see countless different games being played in arcade cabinets, which if the main criticism leveled is that it's a giant Nintendo commercial, well, the giant Nintendo commercial happens at the end when you get Super Mario Brothers 3. But even though a bunch of these games that you see on your way to Super Mario Brothers 3 also happen to be available for Nintendo Entertainment System home consoles, they're all on arcade cabinets. You don't see a physical NES for the majority of the runtime. Now, what I will say is the piece of Nintendo ephemera that does get some very generous attention is the Power Glove.
Jeez. I love the Power Glove. It's so bad.
And I've got to say that the popularity that the Power Glove saw, I really think a lot of it came from the fact that kids saw it in this movie. It rode on the coattails of, we're going to see this movie that you see Super Mario Brothers 3. And there's a U.S. sitcom on now called The Goldbergs, starring Jeff Garlin, where it's set in 1980-something, so that they can fudge the timelines of when different pop culture references happen and so on. And they did an episode in their first season specifically about the main kid seeing the wizard and becoming enamored of the Power Glove. So it's something that there is this lasting, you'll see animated GIFs, you'll see memes of this character with the Power Glove saying, I love the Power Glove, it's so bad.
It really was. That was the first time in the movie when I really felt like, wow, this is a huge product placement. Yeah. There's absolutely no reason for this thing to be in the movie other than a lot of money has changed hands.
Yeah, it sticks out like a sore thumb. And it's a moment like that that cancels out all of the other, just, these are a whole bunch of video games that you see in arcades all over the place. Some of them, I don't know that all of the games were necessarily actually arcade cabinet games.
I think most of them were actually, yeah, home games that they put on a screen in a make-believe cabinet for the set.
Which seemed kind of odd, but, you know, at the time when arcades were really a thing, that was what people were accustomed to. So even though it kind of broke with reality, it fit better for the narrative. So
you've got to show people what they think an arcade game, a video game is. Exactly. And most people at that time, yeah, thought of the kids in arcades.
The counterintuitive nature of it being a giant product placement commercial is that only two pieces of the actual product that's placed is placed in a context that makes sense relative to how people would go to the store and buy such a thing. But yeah, it's all over the place. Now, if it were strictly a Nintendo commercial, you wouldn't see Capcom and Tecmo games and Konami games and all of these other publishers' games throughout the movie.
True.
But if you want to think of it as a giant product placement for home video games in and of themselves, yeah, absolutely.
And yet, here's the thing. I was checking the time codes on this. This movie goes on for more than 15 minutes before we see any video game footage at all.
Uh-huh.
There's almost no mention of video games even in the first 15 minutes, but certainly we are 15 minutes in before we see any game footage. And then when we do, it's the original Double Dragon of all things.
And, you know, we have the stock divorced dad who can't keep a house clean or cook worth a damn. And
cook a casserole, yeah.
And the rebellious Christian Slater older son who's drinking and out partying and stealing the truck.
This has to be one of Christian Slater's earliest roles, surely, or certainly as an adult.
When he made that transition to being, you know, the fully voice changed adult who can drive you around kind of character. It really was. And I think it introduced him to an entire fandom that wasn't as familiar to him as his, it's safe to say, predominantly, teen or young girl fan base was up until then.
That's a point, actually. I didn't look this up, but was this before or after Pump Up the Volume?
That's a good question.
Because it's around the same time, really, isn't it? It's certainly the same era.
It's around the same time, and it's definitely around the same time as Heathers, which, granted, was more of an underground sort of a thing, you know, to the extent that you could consider it such a thing with the kind of popularity that it has now.
Pump Up the Volume was the year after.
Yeah, it was the year after. This was just on the cusp of that. But it did come after he was in The Legend of Billie Jean. He was doing made for TV specials like the Hank Williams Jr. story.
I missed all of those being over here.
Yeah, well, this was just the year after Heathers. I'm looking at reference material. Heathers was 1988. Tucker, The Man and His Dream was 1988. And this was the year before Young Guns 2, Pump Up the Volume. And then a couple years later, Mobsters, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Robin Hood doesn't count.
Well, yeah, what Robin Hood, where?
The less said about that movie, the better.
Hey there, I'm Robin Hood. I'm here to save you, Maid Marian.
Maybe that's one I'll have to find somebody to come on and defend.
I don't know. I might have to beg a return trip. I have some fond memories of that terrible, terrible movie, because where else can you find Alan Rickman vowing to dig someone's eye out with a spoon?
Okay, so let's bring it back to here and talking about terrible movies. Let's be honest. By any objective measure, The Wizard is not a great movie. It's not even a good movie. It's barely competent.
I would say that it is, I would disagree with you there. I would say that it is a competently assembled version of spare parts we've seen a million times previously. It is the sort of thing that maybe would be straight to a cable channel these days and had a 10 times bigger budget than it would in this day and age. I would say that it's competently put together for the type of movie that it is, and some of the elements definitely shine through better than others. There are wildly different consistencies in terms of performances.
Oh God!
The kid who plays Jimmy is fantastic. He's very, very good.
Yeah, he is actually. Yeah, yeah. Whereas by contrast, the guy who plays the bounty hunter, oh my God, he's terrible.
Am I thinking of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang? Where there's a child catcher character. He's almost as arch and over the top as that sort of a thing. I mean, short of a long enough mustache to twirl, he's just about ready to tie someone to railroad tracks.
It really is. Yeah. Just, I couldn't believe it. Cause I was going to say, even though, you know, I will argue with you, I really don't think it's a competent movie in terms of direction, editing, etc. But
I said competently assembled, not executed.
But the performances are generally actually very good, apart from that one character. Even when he's introduced, you know, when the divorcing the wife and her new boyfriend say, oh, and we've hired this private investigator, he specializes in finding kids. And you look at him and you're like, no kid with half a brain is going to go anywhere near that guy. He looks like some kind of bizarre molesting criminal. And then the performance was bad as well. I mean, maybe it was bad direction, who knows? But either way, that was so strange.
It was so much like it was directed as, look, this is a movie for kids, so act like it's a movie for kids.
Go big,
period, end of story. Yeah, the fellow who plays the new stepdad, who is kind of the stereotypical, jackass stepdad character, Sam McMurray, he's one of these that guy character actors who... That's what he plays a lot of. He was in Raising Arizona, Christmas Vacation.
I didn't know his name, but as soon as I saw him on screen, I'm like, oh, I've seen you before.
Oh yeah, yeah, that guy. He's on a sitcom in the U.S. Called Cristela, the rare major network sitcom that has a Hispanic lead playing the good old boy Republican super conservative head of the law firm, and playing this same kind of type of the foil to everything that is good and progressive in the world. And it's something that he does well. And that is a stock type. I mean, if you want to look at this as a commedia dell'arte style presentation of tropes, it succeeds admirably. If you're looking at it as a believable, deeply felt, highly emotional, sort of story, it's the sort of thing that you have to hook on to those performances, like I would say arguably in various places, Beau Bridges as the dad.
Doing that thing. Have you ever noticed how actors of a generation beyond ours, basically who didn't play games when they were kids, who were too old to have grown up playing video games, have no idea how to act playing a video game? They're throwing the controller around, they're jerking it up and down, they're button mashing like crazy.
Yeah.
It's insane. If you ever actually watch a real person playing a video game, their hands barely move. It's ridiculous. It's like you're not in a theater.
It's akin to, it makes me think of, you know, Han Solo has never touched a lightsaber in his life, but he picks it up with the consideration in Empire Strikes Back of, all right, this is a finely tuned instrument. I don't know how this works. I got to figure out how this thing works. People a generation removed from us who pick up a video game controller are just like, I don't know what the relationship is between pushing buttons or touching this thing and what happens on the screen is, and I'll be damned if I care. So I'm just going to look like I'm real damn enthusiastic about it.
Right. And I'm not going to learn. Yeah. It was just absolutely crazy. I couldn't. And he's not the only one. Plenty of other people doing it as well. And then you get to, and we're obviously jumping ahead, but you get to the climax where the kids are actually, you know, playing the game in the competition, and they're all playing it quite normally. It's only 1989. So these things, it's not like these things were in every household by then, but these kids instinctively knew, yeah, you don't throw it around and twist your body around and look like you're playing Dance Dance Revolution.
That's the thing is, I feel like the kid actors who are actually playing the games, there are some of them you can tell, like they take on the stance of a seasoned game player.
Right. Yeah,
and there
are
others that seem like they are more, you know, kid actor who looks good in pigtails and nerd glasses, who may not necessarily even be much of a gamer, but they have the openness to figuring out how it is that they're supposed to look with this thing, that they're not overacting, look at me, I'm playing a game, but they're going to something that feels naturalistic at the very least, which stands in very stark contrast to, I mean, I would say that the extent to which Beau Bridges goes over the top playing the video game, and almost to an extent Christian Slater, is almost how over the top the host of the big championship event at the very end goes, where it's...
Right, but that's by design.
I thought he was going to transform into a monster or something. Yeah, that guy's doing it on purpose because that's what he's supposed to be doing. These others are just like, I don't know what the hell to do, and my name's on the poster, and that gets me a certain paycheck, so this is what I'm going to do.
I'm glad you mentioned the glasses and pigtails, actually, because one of the things I noted was how diverse the video game players are. I mean, for a start, we have Haley, the heroine, as it were, who is clearly a good game player herself. But then when we get to the championships, I was quite surprised at just how many girls there were both playing, you know, competing and in the audience.
Gamergate didn't get to this movie before they got it out. Otherwise, they would have erased all of that.
It's kind of ironic that 1989 was more progressive about girl gamers than we are here in 2015.
Yeah, that's something that when I rewatch this every once in a while, really stands out. Is granted, mainstream cinema was still not catering very well to the fact that there are a lot of Vietnamese, Korean, Chinese, Japanese American kids, Hispanic American kids, African American kids that were avid gamers. That's certainly who I played games with until our thumbs were sore in my neighborhood. They're not nearly as well represented here as the split in the genders.
That's true.
So at the very least, I'm glad that there is this really good representative swath of young female gamers in this, because that really reflected the way that it was. I would go over to my friend Seema's house, and she and our friend Adam, we would play, I think it was Bugs Bunny Birthday Blowout, and we'd play Super Mario Brothers, and we'd, you know, balloon fight, all sorts of different things. Games were not just for one individual kind of person. The more that the retro stuff has come back, I bought NES Remix for the Wii U, just because I love a bunch of these games and screwing around with the dynamics and the challenges and everything that you face in them. It got me back to thinking about how so many games in that era catered to a much wider, gender diverse, gender anonymous audience. It didn't matter who you were necessarily. The game was not just made for you to feel like, well, you could only play Mario Brothers if you were a boy who wanted to save a princess. In fact, the fact that there was a princess at the castle was much less interesting than the fact that you jumped on a bunch of stuff and dodged fireballs shot at you by a giant turtle dinosaur thing.
I do wonder how much of that, if a large part of that, is because of the limitations, actually, in technology. Mm. Because games were... I'll get so much email if I say this, but games were more pure then. And what I mean by that, before everybody complains, is pure in the sense that it had to be about pure gameplay, because you couldn't rely on great graphics or great sound or even great music to an extent to cover up repetitive or poor gameplay. The physical gameplay had to be interesting, and the challenge had to be, well, challenging and, you know, addictive, and it had to do all of these things and entertain you with very, very little technology.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, things were often a lot more abstract.
Gameplay was king.
Yeah. As graphics got better, they became more realistic because everybody was driving towards better graphics because they wanted more realism. But then as soon as they got it, it was, bot shaven-headed space marines with massive guns.
Hey, brother. I just came back from the front. You know, you didn't get that kind of thing in these games. Frankly, Legend of Zelda, a sterling example. I knew loads of female gamers my age when I was a kid who thought the main character's name was Zelda and that it was a girl because it was this blocky little elf character. And there, you know, the graphic sophistication wasn't such that you could necessarily always tell the gender of the character that you were playing. Mario Brothers, it was pretty obvious. But Super Mario Brothers 2, for a lot of people, was a big deal because you could, you know, I don't want to get a whole lot of email out of this. I was very much of the contingent that, Mario and Luigi weren't quite as where it's at as Princess Peach and Toad. And more often than not, I would play as the princess because she could fly and none of the rest of them could fly. And there were these interesting dynamics at play that a lot of people forget because everything is Gears of War, Halo, Destiny, Titanfall, how hard can Batman punch somebody off of a roof these days?
Or punch a rock in the case of Resident Evil. I'm looking through my notes and we're talking about competence and technical competence. Here are three things that bearing in mind, like I say, I've never watched this movie. And on first watching, spotted these incredible, first one, You can maybe put this just on the time it was made. So that the bit where they hustle the salesman in the bar,
mm-hmm.
about half an hour into the movie. Now, first of all, the idea that salesmen would be, door-to-door salesmen or traveling salesmen would be playing a video game in a bar in their lunch hour and, you know, sort of competing over who can get the high score. That in itself is crazy, but...
I would say it's not as crazy when it comes to the horrible backward culture that is the United States of America. I'm going to get email for that. That in and of itself.
All right. Well, let's take that as read. But then the kids walk into a bar by themselves. So there we are again, kids. They walk in a bar by themselves. They hustle the guy. There's no footage of the kid beating the guy's score. There's barely any footage of him playing the game.
You take it as given. He has superpowers. How could he not?
Well, sure. Well, and they tell you that he beat him, but there is no footage of it. Now, in a modern movie, there'd be a full-on four-minute montage with Michael Kamen's score blasting in the background. I was waiting for it. I was like, okay, now show us the game. Show us the game. Oh, we're cut to the next scene.
I actually, it's something that, of course, I've seen this many times now. It was actually one of my younger brother's favorite movies. We played over and over again, individual sequences of it. I've seen it in bits and pieces more, I think, than I've seen the whole thing all the way through from start to finish. But I, you know, when I do watch it all the way through, things like that, I enjoy not having it beaten over my head of this is where the montage goes every single time. And there are, fair share of montage bits that are used throughout the movie. But this one in particular, it's something that I frankly saw as okay, enough already, you get it. The kid's going to beat whoever comes at him. And it's demonstrative to me in film language of, we don't even need to show it to you. That is how good he is. Get used to it. Period. End of story. You don't need to see him beat every single one of these people because he is that good that you just have to assumptively go, oh, this is going to be the next sucker.
I guess maybe if I was watching it at the time, maybe that's what I would have taken from it. But watching it as a modern viewer, I was just like, hang on, where's the scene of him actually playing the game? Okay, so second thing, They spend the whole movie talking about the fact that they've got no money. The whole reason he's hustling these guys is to get money, to get to Reno. They get on a truck, they get all their money robbed. They spend a lot of time talking about how they've got no money. And then, after they win a few hundred dollars with the help of, you know, some weird guy helping them out on the craps table, which, you know, again, hello, great role model for kids. They win a few hundred dollars, and now suddenly they spend what appears to be days on a premium phone helpline, which now, I mean, I've got to think that most people listening to this probably don't remember, you know, probably aren't old enough to remember those, but that you used to get a phone number printed in the back of your
Nintendo Power.
Yeah, in the back of the manual for the video game, yeah. Saying if you get stuck, you know, here's the helpline. And it was always a premium rate number because they wanted to make a lot of money out of that. Mm-hmm. You would phone up the number and say, I'm stuck on level 36. I can't get past the dragon. And they would give you hints and tell you how. Sometimes it was automated. Sometimes it was, you know, a real person at the end of the line like it is in this movie. But they were always crazy expensive phone lines. And now suddenly they've got enough money to just sit by the side of a pool in an expensive hotel and call this premium phone line for ages and go through, how many was it? 94 different games?
Something like that. It strains the suspension of disbelief in a variety of directions. But it's the concept itself is thin enough that it's, you know, it's thin, but not necessarily terribly much thinner than a bunch of child focused movies of the same era. I had not seen The Goonies until I was an adult.
Oh, wow.
I'm saying it publicly. Yes. What an admission to make. Wasn't terribly thrilled with it. Granted, I was seeing it in my 20s. But there's a lot of really thin narrative all surrounding that movie. And that it is a bit of common currency among all of these kid focused at the time, decent sized budget movies that were coming out from Universal and Warner Brothers and Fox and so on. Mm-hmm. So I would say in comparison to the other stuff that's out there, I mean, you would have to just damn the entire genre of kid friendly, you know, adventure quest movies.
It's probably true. I'm sure if I sat down and watched them now, I could spot holes like this of them.
Space Camp Explorers. I mean, there are holes all over all of them that are just beyond the suspension of disbelief of, you know, they travel to another planet or The Last Starfighter.
Sure, but you accept that. That's the, you know, every movie gets one thing like that you have to buy into.
And I think a lot of it, because the movie really was very directly intended for a kid audience, kid movies are not very good about the actual logistics of money and the limits of money. And money becomes the most plentiful limited resource, even when that's a major plot driver, money suddenly starts raining from the sky.
There was the final thing is just a tiny little thing, but
is it from right near the end of the movie?
It is near the end of the movie, and it's,
I have a feeling I know what it is. Go ahead.
It's to do with the tannoy. No, this isn't what you were thinking, is it? Okay, so when the finalists are announced, they announce their numbers. The numbers that they've got, that they were given on the way in, that they've got stapled to the back of the shirt, and then their names. But nobody ever told them Jimmy's name, and yet they know his full name.
Oh, yeah.
They call out his full name, and I'm like, nobody told them that.
The authorities did, or someone did. I don't know. The Deus Ex Machina.
That's the sort of thing that I will always let slide. You know, willing to let slide. But it just struck me as like, hang on a second.
Well, how would they not know his name? He's the star of the movie.
But I was gonna say, you were talking about tropes and how the movie is, you know, largely a collection of tropes. But one thing I did like was that it seems to be quite knowing about many of them. One of them is my favorite line in the movie when the tour guide, everything's going wrong on the tour, and the tour guide shouts, "Everybody, please sit down and have fun, damn it." Just that cracked me up. That was the best line in the movie. But also earlier with the whole power glove scene, and you get a kind of almost Ennio Morricone whistling come through, yeah. And the direction suddenly takes on this Sergio Leone feel, and everybody's staring at one another and close on people's eyes, and you're like, whoa, hang on a second. That's really quite knowing for a kid's movie.
And it, there are things like that, that little references that I picked up on, specifically the Leone stuff, that I hadn't seen The Good, Bad, and the Ugly or any of those spaghetti westerns up until then, that when I finally did see them, I was like, wait a minute.
Oh, so you saw this before seeing any of those?
I was six, man. I, you know.
Oh, I forget how young you are, yeah.
What parent in their right mind would have shown their child The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly at five? Here's a three-hour Western. Let's watch this and see if you could pay attention.
See, it was just always on television on public holidays here, so.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, is I became this movie nut, you know, all the way through elementary school and junior high school and high school. So I did eventually see it, and I got that it was a whole thing. And in the various other instances of other movies referencing those Leone Westerns, something that I kept wanting to tell myself, no, it's just nostalgia because that's the first one that you saw it in. Still to this day, I think among the ones that went for the really, you know, the cheap stylistic reference, this one actually gets it better than a lot of the other ones that try to make too knowing of a reference to it, where you pick up on the fact that I haven't seen whatever this is talking about, but I guess I'm just going to laugh anyway. It actually works in the context of the language of the scene.
It's not too over the top. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not too Disney Channel, and I use Disney Channel as a pejorative for a very good reason. The little thing toward the end that I thought you were going to bring up.
Right, yeah, I was going to say, so what is that? Tell me.
Super Mario Brothers 3, anybody who's played Super Mario Brothers 3, know that what they put on the screen is World 1-2. That's not World 1-2. That's World 1-3.
Oh, really?
And it's because at the time that they made the movie, the game was not done yet. And what we now know is level 1-3 or 1, I might even have the numbers wrong at this point because I'm getting old. It was actually level 1-2. The order of the levels was reversed. So when the movie came out and once people were playing Super Mario Brothers 3, they were like, well, that's wrong. That's not,
oh, that's crazy.
That's not, you know, that was the big schoolyard nitpick that we all thought we were so smart for noticing.
Oh, I love that.
What kind of an idiot wouldn't notice that? Well, only the kind of moron who hadn't played Super Mario Brothers 3, because I mean, how could you miss such a thing?
My confession is that I have never played any Super Mario Brothers game all the way through.
Ashamed of you. You've obviously not played three levels into that one.
I've barely even picked up any of them. I did pick up most of the sort of original Nintendo Mario games, but I never completed any of them. They don't hold any interest for me at all, I'm afraid. They're just not my kind of games.
It was a big motivator for me when my best friend from the street over had gotten the Nintendo and introduced me to video games, which I didn't know existed. And we played Super Mario Brothers for hours. That and Duck Hunt and World Class Track Meet, which came on this combo cartridge with a particular bundle of the NES. I think for me it was that foundational video gaming experience where I had not played another video game before I played Super Mario Brothers.
Wow. And do you realize, for a movie about games, mm-hmm. and that was slammed by none less than Roger Ebert, but, you know, pretty much everyone else as well, for being one big ad for video games, there is less than 6 minutes of actual gameplay footage in this entire 92-minute movie.
And that's 6 minutes more than we had been used to in just about any movie, you know, up until that time. So it felt like a buffet.
I guess, yeah. It shows just how, you know, you don't have to put much of something new and unusual in for people to think, oh, it's dominating this whole film. And it really wasn't. And most of it was devoted to Super Mario Brothers 3 at the end anyway, in that final scene.
Yeah. You know, to be honest, it is much more a movie about the other stuff. But I think that perspective of not being used to any of it whatsoever in a movie is part of what might have very well driven the perspective that Ebert and various other reviewers took on it, because they weren't used to seeing any of it in one of these movies. And it was seen as this new consumerist scourge that was going to take over children's minds and unfairly influence them against reading and actual culture.
And going to the movies.
and going to the movies, for God's sake. You know, it was going to be the end of the movies. And as we all know, no one sees movies anymore.
No one saw movies after they introduced sound. Nobody saw movies after they made them color. Nobody saw movies after the video games were invented.
You know, six minutes of video game footage was six more minutes than anybody was generally used to seeing in just about anything across the board. And of course, cultured film reviewers who would rather be watching another Antoine Doinel movie from Francois Truffaut, they would be looking at this movie, The Wizard, and say, well, this is garbage compared to the 400 blows. Give me the 400 blows any day, every day, 7 days a week, instead of this garbage that tells children to just take mom and dad to Toys R Us and buy you the new video game set.
You know, thinking about it, I wonder if maybe the reason I find the lack of games in a movie ostensibly about games so unusual is maybe I'm comparing it to BMX Bandits from 1983, an Australian movie starring a very young Nicole Kidman.
Yes, I was about to say, one of Nicole Kidman's big breakthrough efforts.
But I saw that movie when it came out. I was 11 when that movie came out, so I was right smack firmly in the target audience. I mean, that movie is a huge advert for BMX. Nobody would ever, even its biggest fans, would never deny that it is just one huge commercial for BMX bikes.
Yeah.
However, there were a lot of BMXs in that movie. There was a lot of BMX action. They were on their bikes a lot more than 6 minutes, let me tell you. And I think maybe that's why looking at The Wizard and only seeing a few minutes of game footage, maybe that's why it strikes me as unusual.
Well, you compare it to something like Mac and Me, which for McDonald's was the BMX Bandits of McDonald's movies in terms of the way it was just saturated throughout it. And I should say BMX Bandits really as a movie beyond the BMX placement is one of the best things that auteur Brian Trenchard-Smith has ever done. Among many other fantastic action exploitation movies.
I love that you even know the name of the director. You're going to tell me you've interviewed him now, haven't you?
I've not. I've tried. I've followed him on Twitter and he DM'd me. Well, some assistant or PR agency DM'd me, check out his new something or another on Trailers from Hell or something like that.
Well, that's better than DMing you to say, leave me alone.
Well, I came to know what BMX Bandits was because of Stunt Rock, which came out a couple or 3 years before it, and is a movie about stunts and a movie about rock, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, but I'll be damned if it isn't one of the most effectively cut trailers directed toward a young male audience that I've ever seen.
If you like peanut butter and you like chocolate, yeah, I get you.
But yeah, it is. It is kind of interesting that with the benefit of 25 years or so distance, looking at it as compared to other movies that have either directly involved video games or, you know, like Wreck-It Ralph been all inside of a video game world.
Mm.
That thing really is that more than anything is a commercial for video games and the narrative of gaming and all that kind of stuff. Where you get a fraction of the video game universe, which, you know, granted was still pretty much in its infancy as its own kind of subculture or thing that people can be self-described as, you know, I play games.
Yeah.
In the day and age that this movie came out in, it was that was the window dressing, the icing on the cake, not the substance of the cake, so to speak.
One final thing, I think, and that's the very end of the movie. After the competition, of course, the wizard wins the contest. Of course he does. You know, that's inevitable. Everybody goes crazy. The parents are converts. They all love him now, and they all love the fact that he plays games, whatever. And then the very end, when they're driving home and they go past those dinosaurs in California. I can't remember what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
But that big dinosaur, you know, statues. And Jimmy, the kid, starts going nuts and clearly wants to sort of get out and go to these dinosaurs. I thought that was that whole scene. I'm not going to say too much because, you know, if you never know, people might actually go and look for this movie and watch it. I thought that whole scene was very well handled, actually. Very, very sympathetic. But, I mean, you will know, like I say, I don't want to give too much away in case people want to watch this movie. But like all the time, the parents are going, why is he going nuts? Why is he going crazy for the dinosaur park? And then when you get to the end and you realize why he was going nuts, you're like, how could you not know that?
It's something that I particularly enjoyed because, as you know, I love my parents and I think they're wonderful and they did everything within their power to understand and be there for my younger brother and everything. But there is something to poet of our times, Willard Smith's ode, Parents Just Don't Understand. There's something to that in this that was kind of satisfying to me as a kid watching it, which is that, yeah, that the parents didn't get that was the underlying reason that he wanted to go to this specific place is something that was more authentic to me than most of the rest of the movie. The parents were so involved in the way that they were obsessed with the world revolving around what they considered normal and the way that they considered life to be, that they were not open-minded enough to try even to think about it from his perspective. They just assumed that it was some outlandish thing that must have not made sense. When at the end of the movie, and again, this doesn't spoil anything, it makes all of the sense in the world.
Yeah, you realize that it's entirely logical. Of course it makes sense.
And for me, that payoff is what completely wipes away any of the logical inconsistencies, bizarre, outlandish, over-the-top camp performances or bits or reactions or weird bits of dialogue or really troubling messages being put out there as to, you know, what kids should go and do on their own when parents don't listen to them. It absolves that kind of stuff from what the movie deserves in terms of how of the estimation that it should be given. It's the sort of thing that I feel like the credited screenwriters, and who knows, uncredited screenwriters, you never know in Hollywood, that they got through that kind of authenticity, some of the authenticity that you get in the beginning of the movie, this movie that's ostensibly a giant video game product placement that I'm sure they were paid handsomely for, that they managed to sneak that into this kind of a movie makes it infinitely more valuable than movies that people say, oh, well, that's a guilty pleasure. Oh, I like that from when I was a kid. I'll still say that Howard the Duck movie is not as bad as people say that it is, but it doesn't have something authentic at its core that is more than just kind of a template-based narrative to it. This one is actually trying to say something under the enormous weight of generic, kid-friendly studio comedy adventure caper. And that's something that really does make it stick out, more so than just the kind of basic, parents should listen to their kids more often. It goes a bit deeper than that. And that's, you know, at its heart, at its core, beyond the very personal connection that I have to it. For me, what makes me still somewhat admire it, and I should mention, a few years ago, I want to say, might have been 2007, 2008, a friend of mine who now works for Rooster Teeth here in Austin, Jack Patillo, held a screening of The Wizard at the Alamo Drafthouse downtown and had the director, Luke Edwards, who played Jimmy, and Fred Savage, who played his brother, at the screen to do a Q&A. And it was mostly filled with gamers who were, you know, worshiping at the altar of the movie that dared show them Super Mario Brothers 3 when they were 8 years old. But I went up to the table and talked to them afterward as they were signing posters for people. And as a fully grown adult, I thought to myself, I'm going to say, you know, this is what this movie meant to my younger brother, who's autistic. It's what it, you know, meant to me. As ridiculous as it might have been making it, maybe I'm seeing more in it than was really intended. And the director, you know, he's done a bunch of stuff that's like, you know, Firehouse Dog and, you know, straight to cable, family friendly stuff that it's a living, it's not deep high art. He was absolutely speechless that the thing that was the whole reason that he took the job, that he took the script, that about 20 years later, somebody had their entire life affected by that. And seeing that wash over his face after being approached by a bunch of, you know, people that, you know, were like, so did you think like it was weird that you put World 1-3 where World 1-2 is supposed to be? 'Cause that was like wrong. It was amazing seeing that. And Fred Savage, speechless as well. And I told him that as silly and disposable and junk food like as people might try to categorize whether this movie, whether it's family friendly TV that you direct, he was already directing heavily. He's now one of the, I think, the most frequent directors on Modern Family throughout that show's run. There are those rare things that more, you know, the Wonder Years, of course, but that you don't expect to sneak something in there in its closing minutes that really can be more substantive and affecting than you would think at first glance.
See, if I'd been at that screening, I would have asked him, how come when the PA says it's 2 minutes to go, the clock only says 1 minute?
Because there was a miscommunication in the booth and people are,
it's
know,
a
fallible.
Giant clock. It's 10 feet wide. I think it's time to close this out. Moises, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
My podcast network, ESN, can be found at esn.fm, where I've got a variety of different shows, some hosted by myself, some not. The three that I started with nearly a year ago, Electric Shadow, is about the past, present, and future of cinema, a very wide-ranging series of subjects that we discuss on that show at varying levels of the depth, depending on the topic. Giant Size, which you've been on in what I call its origins phase or volume one phase, where we make specific types of comics, characters and so on more approachable for people so that you don't feel like you have to have been reading comics for 40 years. And Thank You for Calling, which is a show about the world of customer service and looking at both sides of customer service interactions in a variety of different fields. And from a variety of different angles. It doesn't just necessarily have to be, how do I get out of customer service hell stories, but looking at what the person on the other end of the transaction is dealing with. As we're recording this, the most recent episode that I have up is speaking with a young woman who worked in a U.S. Medicare call center for some time and talking about what it's like to be the person who has no further information to give.
So basically, you're encouraging people to be reasonable and understanding. Isn't that kind of un-American?
Well, I'm trying to change that to being the most American thing that you can believe.
A righteous cause. Where on Twitter, you're Moises Chiu, I believe, yeah?
Moises Chiu. And between the website and the Twitter, that's where I live most of the time. So please come and enjoy the podcasts and tweet all of your complaints and plaudits in equal measure.
Excellent. Moises, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, Episode 3, with Anthony Johnston and Moises Chuyan. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Tell me, what is this about the horse? Tell me.
Oh, my wife has ridden horses Western style since she was a kid. She would mostly, when she was growing up, she would do what's referred to as barrel racing, where there are three barrels in an arena, and in something like 15 seconds, the horse enters the arena, loops around the left or right barrel, then does kind of a figure eight pattern around the opposite one, and then hooks left or right, depending on which barrel you choose to take second. To go around the one furthest away in the arena. They're set up in a clover leaf pattern.
Right.
And yep. Then they, dash back out of the arena. And, again, 15, 16 seconds or so. If you're really good, you're in the 14-second range. And then when we moved to Austin, she found that it was less appealing to her for a variety of reasons, and she started to take up team roping. And the horse that she's had for many years, it turns out he has a type of hoof disease called navicular disease, which is rather common in horses, unfortunately, where there's nothing wrong with him, just generally ambling about and being a horse. but athletically speaking, it was no longer a good idea to have him competing. So
right, yeah.
Her aunt had a horse that she knew quite well and that was safe and well-behaved and good-tempered that she was willing to just let us have.
Wow.
Provided we would come and get it. And so we hooked up the trailer and the truck and headed across the country, and I sat there tapping away on my laptop working while she drove. And so we got him back just a couple days ago, and now I am not as behind as I thought I'd be. I actually got quite a bit done.
But behind nevertheless, yeah.